Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
Finding someone on an online Catholic dating site shouldn't be like shopping for a blender. So why do most dating sites leave you feeling like you're shopping for a spouse? At Catholic Singles, we connect members through our unique user polls and activities, which help you discover other members and their personalities and interests. Because you're a person, not a profile picture. So stop shopping and start discerning. Trust your love story to the original Catholic dating site and use the promo code BREADBOX at checkout for 20% off at catholicsingles.com.
The top of the evening to you, everybody. 5 minutes past the hour of 10 o'clock. Speaking to you from the beautiful WCAP studios, welcome to Beneath the Surface, where faith and reason meets here at Radio 980 on your dial. Glad you could join us tonight. And we are here tonight and every Monday night from 10 to 11 p.m., bringing a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little life into our culture of death. Well, tonight, my fellow truth seekers, we go beneath the surface on the topic of death. Yes, you heard it. Death. What it is, why it is, and what to do about it. And to assist us in this extremely mysterious but important topic, there he is, ladies and gentlemen, the living one himself, Mr. John Tudorus.
That is correct.
Yes, what is?
That I'm living. And that I'm not dead.
That you're living and that you're John.
Yes, and that I am John.
Yes, and you're the only one living as John Tudorus.
In the studio right now.
Well, I don't know of anyone else who's living as John Tudorus.
Well, naturally.
Okay. And speaking of living as somebody, we have Cindy behind the glass who's living as Cindy tonight. Cindy, how are you?
I'm okay.
Good. Are you living as Cindy tonight?
Sometimes I'm not sure.
Okay, that's good. Well, I can be sure of that. I can pretty much, I trust my eyes. 978-454-4980 is our phone number here at BTS Radio. 978-454-4980. And we go beneath the surface tonight on the topic of death, a apropos topic for the season, the Christian season of Lent. Mr. John?
Yes.
First of all, before I get beneath the surface with you, let us remain above the surface for the next 12 seconds. Tell me how you're doing.
Great.
Wait. That was 0.7 seconds.
Yeah, I know. That's not enough to fill 12 seconds.
No, it wasn't.
But we're almost there right now.
We are.
Yes, we are.
Okay, there it is. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, so let us get beneath the surface here then. What is death?
I have very little idea. Okay. I mean, I do.
You've never died.
No, I've never died. So I'm lacking an experiential knowledge of what death is.
I think you're not alone in that.
Yeah. There's a certain aspect that death is very much a mystery. Mm. And actually, just before the show started, I was noting that this topic actually got me to thinking about a quote from Augustine about the nature of time. He says, "Ask me what time it is, I will tell you. Ask me what time is, I know not." And someone could also say, "Ask me if someone has died, and I can tell you. Ask me what death is, and I know not."
Hmm. Okay.
Now,
that's a good start.
That's not to say that we can't know something about it. It's just that the fullness of what it is, because we're lacking that experiential knowledge. And really, honestly, I mean, how many people do we know have died and have actually come back?
Well, that actually is a question to ask. Can you die and come back? I know there are a lot of stories about people with experiences. Was that death or was that near death? What is your take on that?
My two cents is it's the latter. It's the near death.
It's near death.
Because if it was really death, then they wouldn't be back.
Well, I guess we'd have to define death then. I think that the medical definition of death is the irreversible cessation of vitality or the irreversible cessation of the life of the organism.
Right, and yeah. the two main ways in which it's often tracked is regarding the heart and then the brain.
Yeah, now when we say irreversible, I think that's the magic word here, because people can't come back from death if the definition of death is irreversible.
That's correct.
Yeah, so then if you begin with the premise that death is the irreversible cessation of the life of the organism, which is, you know, the individual human being, then you'd have to say that these people who have had experiences, perhaps we would call them near-death experiences.
Yes.
All right, that makes sense. So we're going to go over some of these questions. What is death? Why does death occur? And we'll get theological as well as philosophical with that one. What can be do about it? And what happens after death? So let's stay on this what is death for a few minutes, John. In order for us to properly address that question, we'd have to address the question of what is man, and that includes woman, of course, too. So what is your take on what a human being is before we can understand our talk about death?
So what composes a human being is not just our material makeup. There is also an inanimate, some would say, spiritual component to our makeup of who we are.
An immaterial component?
Well, that's correct.
Another word for immaterial might be spiritual. Okay.
Correct. Right. For example, our intellect doesn't have any matter per se. Although we communicate ideas to people, we can think. There's no known depository. For example, when the brain is mapped out, there might be certain ideas of what part of the brain controls certain functions.
Right.
But no one really knows exactly where the intellect resides. It's this immaterial component of a human person, but it's very real.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, some going way back, philosophers have understood the intellect as that which can grasp immaterial objects. And just like a hand can grasp material objects, we can also grasp immaterial objects like ideas and thoughts and concepts, things like, for example, justice. You can't touch it, you can't taste it, you can't smell it, but you understand what that means.
Oh, absolutely. Or even some of the other transcendentals, the good, the true, the
goodness,
beautiful.
Truth, beauty. All of those things. Now, you could say, well, there's a beautiful picture or there is a true mathematical problem. You can point at examples, but you can't point at truth or beauty or goodness itself.
That's correct.
And yet, our minds, our intellects can grasp it. So therefore, if we have something within us that can grasp immaterial truths, there must be a part of us that is immaterial to grasp it. And that's one of the arguments. You know, some of the argumentation behind understanding that we have an immaterial component as human persons, even from non-religious philosophers.
Oh, absolutely. Right. I mean, it goes back, what's the definition for man? Was it Socrates? Man is rational animal?
Aristotle.
Yeah. Right. And of course, yeah. So, I mean, this idea that a man has a material and animal component, but there's a part of him that is greater and is above animals.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, along with that rational part of us is also free will.
Yes.
Which is the ability, of course, to rise above the physiological desires, appetites, to govern the self according to the true and the good, which, of course, are abstract realities, again, that the intellect can grasp. But that ability to rise above our instinctual level tells you something about the immaterial component of the human person too, doesn't it?
It does. It gives signal that it's actually higher than the lower portions.
Yeah, because it's able to look at it and govern it.
Yes. In fact, actually, Aristotle believed that contemplation was the highest action that man could do. And the reason why, actually, is because it most imitated the first cause of all causes, whom we call God.
In contemplation, he said of eternal truths is the highest form of happiness because it happens to be, according to him, the highest part of human nature.
It is.
And it's the part that governs the rest of us according to what is true and good, but it is the rational or intellectual part that understands the true and the good. So far we've talked about the intellect, which can grasp the immaterial. the free will, which can rise above our physiological selves to govern it according to what is true and good, intellect, free will, and the third thing one might look at is self-consciousness. Other animals are conscious, but there's that aware of the self that humans are uniquely conscious of, no?
Oh, I would say yes. There's a somewhat funny video, as you mentioned this, yes. Someone had going around, was it the gorilla, that where they put the mirror out there, and he goes and charges the mirror, not because he's seeing himself, but he thinks it's another alpha male gorilla that he's looking to challenge and, you know, throw hay in the air and beat his chest on.
It's that self-reflection that is uniquely human. And again, just by virtue of being able to reflect and to know the self and to govern the self and to say, I think, I feel, to use that word I is a telltale sign that there's something higher in us than just the physiological.
Oh, sure. I mean, language in itself. I mean, obviously the actual physical image is just one portion of it. As what you're really getting at is the actual contemplative part, that we're actually able to recognize these things about ourselves.
Yeah, and only an immaterial intellect can do that, the argument goes. And having self-consciousness, only an I, whatever that is, the letter I, is able to govern the self according to what is true and good. So here we have laid out something that goes above the physical component of the human person. And at death, then, and this is where the death comes in, what happens at death between the parts of the human person?
Well, certainly the material portion of the person dies.
And
the heart stops, the brain waves stop, the functions that are normal stop, there's rigor mortis sets in, decay happens in the body.
Okay, that's important, because two things were just mentioned there. Form and life. When, in other words, as soon as a person dies, they begin to disintegrate.
Yes.
Within. That principle of integration of all body parts is no longer there.
Yes, and the process happens almost immediately.
Yeah.
I mean, we often don't see it because you bring the deceased person's body to maybe do a funeral home. They get embalmed. So
right.
there's this certain preservation that goes on.
Right.
But if that didn't happen, someone would quickly decay.
Yeah, and so that disintegration or decay, rigor mortis, that occurs immediately at death, and so does, of course, the more obvious one perhaps, the lack of life.
Yes. Yeah. No breath.
No breath, no vitality, nothing in the EKE, the brain waves, nothing with the heart monitor. It's just complete deadness. So you have lack of life and lack of form. And would you say that this material, the immaterial part of the person, is what gives it both of those things? It's what gives the physical body its integration and form as well as its life principle?
Yes, with some speculation added to that. So when I say yes, in so much as that the soul of a person, there's this term, the soul is the form of the body, meaning that the soul is the perfection or the act, if you will, of what a person is, and then the body actually takes its shape, takes its cues directly from the soul itself. Now, the soul itself, of course, as we noted, is immaterial. So when there's no matter, there's no decay per se, and there's no change in time, really. But because of this very intimate link in the being that is man between the soul and the body, where was I going with this?
Well, the body goes into the ground at death.
Yes.
The body begins to decay and decompose. But souls, of course, are purely simple. They don't have parts.
Correct.
Like a body does, so it can't disintegrate.
Exactly.
So what happens?
Well, Aristotle actually assumed that they were immortal in the sense that they just don't die. Now, certainly, at least as far as we know in time, someone comes into an existence. But once the material body dies, at that point, they're actually a disembodied soul.
So it's interesting how, throughout all of human history,
you know, much before Christianity, you had this recognition of the human soul surviving bodily death. Just about across the board.
Yes.
You had the ancient Greek philosophers, coming up with it through reason. You had almost every other culture having some recognition of afterlife. Sometimes there was in the form of ancestor worship, and other times there were always cemeteries and you know praying or talking to people, praying to them after death, assuming that they still exist even though their body has decayed. So this recognition of a soul, a human soul that lives on after bodily death, transcends religion.
Yes, it does. You could actually almost say that it's natural for a person to recognize this immaterial, animating part of our being.
Okay. After the break, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to talk more about this, whether this is a good thing or not to separate soul from body. And if it's not a good thing, then why does it happen? 978-454-4980 is our phone number here at Beneath the Surface. I'm Paul Morano, your host. My guest this week, is my first week of the month guest, Mr. John Tudoris. Cindy behind the glass doing all the producing work tonight, as usual. And don't go anywhere. We'll be right back right after this quick break. Hey, we're back. 978-454-4980. I thought that was a commercial. I told Cindy before the show, Cindy, you can play Boston's Peace of Mind like usual just at the beginning and at the end of the show and surprise me with everything else. And so she did exactly that, and it took me for a loop.
And that was very regal.
Yeah, it was. All right, 1023 here at Beneath the Surface Radio at WCAP. I'm Paul Morano. John Tudoris, again, is my guest this weekend. And we're talking about the topic, apropos as it is in Lent, of death. What it is, why it is, and what to do about it. Can't wait to get to that last one. But, all right, we'll be at the very end here of what it is before we get to why it is. How's that?
Yeah.
All right. So, whereas the medical scientific definition of death is the irreversible cessation of the life of the organism, the religious, at least from a Catholic point of view, a Christian point of view, the religious definition of death is the separation of soul from body.
Yes.
Okay. Body goes into the ground. Soul, which is immaterial and substantial, the consciousness of the person, if you will, that which has the higher powers of intellect and will, survives bodily death. What happens to it?
Well, we might be skipping ahead there.
All right.
Towards the end, but
that's a good point.
Yeah, but as far as that point where there would be this disembodied soul, I thought was really fascinating, is that Aristotle, again, he thought it was that there were actually created beings that were pure spirit, and since they had no matter to begin with, they would have a certain immortality by their nature. For example, these beings might be out in the cosmos guiding planets along, and of course this is before the concepts of gravity and what have you, as far as guiding things, the celestial bodies and the rotations and what have you. But at the same time, he thought there must be powerful beings out there guiding.
Invisible to us.
And so if there's this possibility of these invisible yet very much existing beings, and they are pure spirit, they have no matter, that if there is a person and their soul is separated from their body in death, that's that soul, to a certain degree, is like that creature or that being that was created without matter to begin with. And he called these separated substances. It's an odd term, but this idea that, of course, at least in reference to people, it kind of makes sense that they're that the soul and the body are separated from each other. The substance of a person, which is actually designed to be, at least the human person, this what he called a hylomorphic reality. So use that in your next Scrabble game, hylomorphic. There is this intimate union between both the matter and the spirit of a person, and the two are inextricably linked together.
Okay, a couple of thoughts from that nice little information that you just gave. It does seem a bit arrogant for human beings to think that all there is, all the creatures, even intelligent creatures that there are, we can see with our eyes.
Yeah, actually, to a certain degree, I would say yes.
To hold that as dogmatic seems a bit arrogant to say, as if we can, you know, grasp all of reality with our simple, finite, five little bodily senses.
Oh, and just think about all the material creatures that we don't even see that exist all around us.
Yeah, that too, of course. But so then Aristotle, who of course was before, you know, non-Christian, non-Jewish, non-monotheistic, he was searching, of course. He ended up being a deist, but he reasoned the point that, this is the way I would put it, that there are creatures that are bodies without spirits, and we call those animals because they're animated. There are creatures that have spirits without bodies, or are spirits without bodies, and Aristotle called them separated substances. In the Christian tradition, we call them angels. And then there are creatures that are both, that have both body and spirit, and we call those human beings.
Yes.
We're sort of like the bridge between heaven and earth.
Yeah. Yeah, right. That's actually not a bad way to put it.
Between angel and animal. Okay, so then you're saying that what is death? Death is the separation of soul from body. The disembodied soul we'll get to that, what exactly happens to disembodied souls of human beings later in the show. But they're not angels. They're not meant to be pure spirits like angels are. But they are, in a sense, not complete human beings in this disembodied state. Awaiting, you could say, and this we'll get to the end, and this is what Easter is all about, right? Awaiting a reunification, which Christians call resurrection.
Yes, okay. that which is in, there's a certain principle, that which is in potency, or that which has potential, desires to be fulfilled in actuality.
All right, why does death occur?
So why does death occur?
Yeah, why death? Now, a lot of people, I know you're going to give a good answer to this, but let me just tell you what I think a lot of people are thinking with that question. They think it's a foolish question because, like other animals and even plants, we go through this cycle of life and we end up dying like everything else. So let me ask it again and you'll fill in all the blanks. Why do human beings die?
Well, first I would add that I don't think people were designed to die from the beginning.
Really?
Yeah.
Do we not have animal physiological bodies that wear out and get old and die?
We do.
Okay.
We do. But I'm of the belief and thought that the original first parents, so to speak, in the lineage of human race, had a natural perfection to them, both in the union between their soul and their body, as well as the powers that their soul and their body had.
It does seem odd, if you look at the human person the way we have set it up in this show, why one major component would be immortal and the other major component would not be. It does seem odd. It does seem unfitting, if you will.
Yes, it is. It would make sense that at least in the beginning, when the mold was being set, it was designed for this natural perfection, at least in the beginning. Of course, it could be a whole other show on what the ultimate destiny would be for man along the way. But at least in the beginning, for the purpose of this show, we say there is a natural perfection in this union and in the powers that come with it.
And Jews and Christians see the beginning of what you're saying in the Adam and Eve story, don't they?
That's correct.
Okay.
And even if not necessarily as an historical, hi, this is Adam, and here's my birth certificate, and this is my wife, Eve, and like these are right. But there's a certain truth that's contained in this allegorical tale.
Yeah, and part of that truth certainly is not that they have Southern accents.
That is absolutely
Southern
correct.
Southern drawls, yeah.
They could have, though. They could have.
Okay. All right, so then at the beginning, you're saying they were offered the power from God?
Yes, okay. Yes. In fact, they were given it from the beginning.
They were offered, I'll say offered, you say given, the power of God to keep soul and body together.
Actually, I'll say both now.
Continuously.
Yes. I mean, in so much as that there was a natural perfection, but that's only the starting point.
Okay.
Ideally, what God wanted is a full incorporation into union with Him. That's the full end of what man is meant to be. Not just a standalone creature separate from God, but actually designed from the beginning to be part of God, not by His nature, but by adoption.
By relationship.
By relationship, yes.
Okay, so then at the beginning, man was made to be immortal.
Yes.
Okay. What changed that?
What changed that is lack of trust in the one whom gave man everything.
Lack of trust in the one that gave man his very existence.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, of course, in the story, we have Adam and Eve in the garden.
Yeah.
They eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, even though they were told not to, and that there was everything else. Mm. So, on the surface, someone might think, what's the big deal? It's a piece of fruit.
Mm.
You know, it's not like you're going off and you're killing someone. Why should something which seems so innocent in nature be such a huge, huge deal? And it's not actually about so much the fruit as the lack of trust that God, whom gave them their very existence, there is nothing that man did to actually warrant his own existence.
Oh, of course not. There's nothing anything or anyone does to warrant their own existence.
Exactly. It is actually pure gift. There's nothing I did to create myself.
No. You didn't say one day, hey, think I'll create myself.
No.
It just doesn't happen.
No. Wake up in the mirror, I look in the mirror, I say, hey, create yourself. Yeah. And I'm here. No, it just doesn't happen.
No. So, no. All right, so then go on with that
line of thinking. So their lack of trust in that God would actually give them everything and has given them everything needed for their perfection. For their goodness.
So it's kind of like if you were to paint a picture, it's like the characters of that picture coming to life and saying, I don't want to be this character. I want to be something much better than this. In fact, I want to be the painter. And so it starts painting his own picture and just completely ignores you.
Yeah.
So that's sort of like what mankind represented in the first parents said to God, I don't want to be under your authority. I want to be my own.
Yeah, and of course, actually, your example is a very good one because what is contained within the painting actually has no powers to create paintings of their own.
And they obviously, the characters in the painting did not create themselves.
Exactly.
The artist did.
Exactly.
978-454-4980 is our BTS hotline here at WCAP. 978-454-4980. Paul Morano here at Beneath the Surface talking with John Tudorus about the topic of death, what it is, why it is, and what to do about it. Anything else, John, to say about why death occurs?
So that actually brings to the point of, so there's the what we call original sin, man, in the lack of trust.
Rejecting God,
who gave them everything.
Yeah.
Essentially reject God and say, I want to know for myself. And so what ends up happening is that first there is a spiritual death.
Because of the rupture between the first parents and God.
That's right.
So that there no more grace, no more spiritual life involved here.
So
okay.
if you eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, you will surely die.
Right.
Now, interestingly enough, materially, they did not die right away.
Not immediately,
But there was a spiritual death.
Yes.
And that was key. That's important. So when that happened, what does that do? Is that actually leads to a disruption within the man and woman themselves. Yeah. there's this rift between the perfection of the immaterial spirit,
right,
and the body that proceeds from it.
And hence their eyes were quote-unquote opened, and they saw themselves naked, and they sewed fig leaves, hiding from each other.
Yes.
Hmm. So then, instead of being completely open to each other, physically, psychologically, and spiritually, and I think probably psychologically and spiritually were certainly represented in those fig leaves, they could no longer be open, completely open their souls to each other because of lust, domination, and everything else that, that incurred with original sin. So now they're separated from God, and there's a separation, in a sense, from each other, a lack of trust, and they hide themselves from God, as the story goes.
Yes.
So now they're ashamed of themselves in the presence of God because of their lack of trust and disobedience.
Yes.
And so this all ends up with first spiritual death, as you mentioned, and eventually that means physical death.
That's correct. And that spiritual death didn't just happen in that one time. It happens each and every time when people of their own free will choose no towards what is good, what is godly, and then choose otherwise. And so there are terms that are often used in that. One, there's different degrees. One is called a mortal, so that would be something that causes such a degree of spiritual death that if someone were to actually material die without reconciliation with God, they would actually there would be a complete and permanent separation. Whereas the other type, which is called a venial, so those type of sins are of a lesser degree.
All right. So then, when we use the word death, I think this is important. When we use the word death, when we speak about death of the person, we speak about the separation of soul from body.
Yes.
When we speak about the death of the soul, we speak about not annihilation, but we speak about a lack of life, which is joy, happiness, peace, and all of those positive things that life gives. So it's a spiritual existence without life.
Yes, and that life only happens with union with the one who gives that life.
Yeah, so just wanted to clarify that, because when you say that, you know, when you take away life from a body, it actually decomposes and annihilates.
Yes.
It becomes, you know, something else. But when you take away life from a soul, it doesn't annihilate. It remains existent.
It does.
It's just miserable.
Oh, very much
okay.
So.
So that's what we mean by spiritual death. Existence, but a miserable existence.
Very much a miserable existence.
Right. Okay. So then the separated souls are either with grace, i.e. friendship with God, or without it, which means an eternity of misery. We'll get to that in a moment. Let's talk about... Oh, she played Peace of Mind. Now, you see, you're supposed to give me new music for that, too. Before the bumper, or the pre and post bumper, or commercial bumpers. Anyway, 10:39 here at WCAP, 980. You're listening to Beneath the Surface, Paul Morano, John Tudoris, 978-454-4980. If you want to chime in with your comments or questions, be back really quickly right after this. Don't go away. What song is this, John? What is it?
I have no idea.
Oh, come on, you know.
It's a cross between some something else.
Actually, I don't even know. Cindy, what was that song?
A Message to You, Rudy.
Okay, I'll buy that. Good old Rudy. 978-454-4980. You're listening to Beneath the Surface. Our home stretch. Less than 20 minutes, Mr. John, to cover lots of ground. So let's doot.
Oh, yeah.
And that's D-O-O-T. Let's doot.
As in do it?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so what can be done about physical death? Can we create things, medicines, surgeries, et cetera, in the present or in the future, use your imagination, to stave off death continuously?
No. We can prolong
Yes.
A life, but we cannot indefinitely prolong the material life of our power.
How do you know?
It's never been done.
What does that have to do with anything?
Whenever
you create something, it's never been done before, right?
Well, I mean, honestly, if it's something that could be done,
yeah,
there would be something that we could reasonably point to that says it can be done.
Okay, tell me about. Do you know anything about cryogenics?
Yes.
Okay. Is it nonsense?
It's just prolongation. It's freezing.
Yeah.
What happens if someone pulls the plug?
Well, not only that, it's experimental. I mean, it's,
when it comes to freezing, it's not indefinite. I mean, at some point, it slows the decaying process, but decay still happens.
I mean, do you think in 100 years some of these people will be able to wake up?
So you're saying, all right, so let's imagine Ted Williams,
yes,
Michael Jackson, and Walt Disney.
Right.
And they're like a superhero gang, and they come out of the frozen cryogenics 100 years from now. But then they still wouldn't be immortal.
Yeah, they die in a couple of decades anyway. So.
Exactly.
So and it's not, I guess you'd have to just continue. In other words, it's futile. The process is futile in our material, our present state of life.
Yes, and even the other idea that some people posit, transcendence, whereby, let's say, our brain waves are mapped and uploaded into some computer.
Okay.
Well, even that equipment has a finite existence itself, and even
but would that be us? It would just be our brain waves.
Exactly.
Would it be us?
No, because our soul is actually so much more than that.
Okay. All right. So then, then what can we do about death? It doesn't seem like humans are crazy about the idea of dying. Do we just accept it or what?
Yes, we do, actually. Because it's something, a passage that everyone needs to go through.
Yeah.
So the best thing to do is to say, all right, if I can't avoid it, how can I best accept it and prepare for what may be beyond it?
Hmm.
And that I think is real key.
Well, let's get to that then, because I think that's an important part of this whole equation. If you don't have a moral certainty, and it can't come through experience, like you said earlier, and it really can't come through reason, it would have to come through faith, right? About a certainty about the afterlife.
Oh, yes. In fact, I would say that all things involving reason have some things that we have to accept on faith, certain principles, right?
Right.
I'm a natural scientist, if I'm an astronomer, and I have to assume, for example, that gravity exists, that it has certain properties so that I can map the rotations of planets, etc. But I can't fully prove it on why gravity works the way it works. I have to accept it as principle.
And you will have faith that because it has worked this way for so long, it's going to work this way tomorrow.
Exactly.
That's a faith premise. Oh, and by and large, we have to have faith in our senses, too, to believe that our senses are giving us truth.
Absolutely. I mean, I can't fully prove how everything connects together between my five senses, but I know that they work.
Okay, so everything is presumed on faith. Religious faith regarding the afterlife takes something special, does it not? Perhaps a special divine gift?
It is. It is. It definitely requires that gift, which we call grace, in order to accept it. And really, there's a certain reason behind it. I mean, we can accept it because of the authority upon whom gives it. Mm-hmm. Which is God. So it's actually reasonable. It's not to say that this gift is not reasonable and that someone just gives it to you willy-nilly.
And it's been, like we said earlier in the show, it's been, a belief in the afterlife life has been in the human heart throughout every culture, throughout history. So it's not new to a particular religion. However, you as a Christian believe that it has been revealed, divinely revealed, a little something about what happens in the afterlife. So why don't you get on with death, judgment, heaven, and hell?
Certainly. But before I do that, I will say the best way to prepare is to seek to do the good.
right.
So that's what we're made for, is for the good. And that good is not just, you know, making things. It's in our relationship with others and our relationship with the Creator.
Mm-hmm.
So seek the good, do the good. But since we have this imperfection of soul and body, we realize that we also fall short.
Yeah.
And therefore, the second component to that is to ask for mercy when we fall short.
Okay, so act justly and seek mercy.
Yes.
When you fall short of that justice.
And we will always need to seek mercy, without question.
It's funny what you said earlier. Basically, you summed it up, what Jesus said. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself.
Yes.
So when you fail in that mission, you seek mercy. Okay, continue.
Yes. And so so we now get to death's door.
Yes.
We're there. We're at death. What happens?
Yes.
Well, there is judgment. And judgment is broken down into...
You're so judgmental.
Oh, how dare you judge me. Judge not, lest you be judged.
I know. Actually, I am judging you by saying that, aren't
yeah.
I?
Yeah. Well, we actually all use judgment, right?
Of course we do.
And of course, this judgment that Scripture talks about is really a prudential type of judgment regarding the state of someone's soul. Mm. So, for example, I make a judgment that this water that I have here in front of me is good and refreshing.
Yes.
And that I ought to drink it if I want to be nourished.
And that it's not gin or, you know, anything else other than H2O.
Exactly. But my sense is affirmed that it is what it is. I trust that you gave it to me that it's that is what it is. However, I do not see your soul. I do not know what is going on with you. So for me to go in and say, hey, you know, Paul, I think you're going to hell.
That's the kind of judgment that we can't do. We leave that to God.
Exactly.
And that is that what happens after death?
Yes, exactly. He with perfect vision who created us sees us as we are. And then we, of course, are before him as we really are. And there's a certain nakedness, if you will. I mean, there's nothing clothing it ourselves as far as who we are before God.
Just like at the beginning, there was a sort of a nakedness before God before sin entered the world. Okay,
and so see ourselves as we really are, and then from there, we naturally assign ourselves to one of two ultimate places, either through mercy. Because we will certainly need mercy because we fall short of the goodness. We actually accept heaven. And if we need some cleaning up, we go to a place which we call purgatory.
So you're saying that the disembodied soul, after the moment of death, is face-to-face with God.
Yes.
And is judged according to what you're saying now. Did he accept God's mercy and forgiveness in this life and choose to seek God, or did he do the opposite, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. It's one of two choices.
One of two ultimate choices.
Exactly. And there's really no getting around those two ultimate choices.
Yeah.
And, of course, the other place is eternal separation.
Right.
Now, some people may say...
The other place other than heaven.
Yes, and that's what we call hell.
Okay, go ahead.
Now, some people may say, you know, how can an all-loving God send people to hell? And the answer is, he doesn't. We do. Now,
another question to ask related to that is, how could an all-loving God create us as free-willed persons and then disrespect our very nature as actually chose?
Free will is what he gave us, and that's necessary to choose love. We weren't made to be robots to automatically go from point A to point B.
So God doesn't force us to love him. He allows us to do what we want.
Yes,
basically.
That is correct. He actually honors our decision.
Yes.
Believe it or not, it's actually considered an act of mercy for him to allow people to go to hell. Because if they who do not choose to be with him are forced to be in his presence, it would be far more terrible for them.
There's actually some theologians, if I'm not mistaken, that actually think that hell is that the fire of hell is actually the fire of God's love that burns the heck out of them because they're so filled with hate and rejection of love and goodness.
Some thought that. Others, and I think I heard this from Scott Hahn, that the fires of hell are also in part due to the nature of Satan, who was a seraphim originally. At least that's what is sought by some.
Kind of an angel.
Burning ones, right? And so their nature is to burn with the love of God. But because he's so turned inward on himself.
After he rejected God.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So instead of being this fire of love, it's a self-consuming fire which infects all those who are in his company.
In a sense, a fire of hatred.
Yes.
Few minutes, 8 minutes left in the show, Mr. John. 978-454-4980 if you want to jump on board and give us a comment or a question. 978-454-4980. You're listening to Beneath the Surface. My guest is John Tudor. So, John, so that's what happens with the disembodied soul after death, face-to-face, judgment, a permanent, your eternal destiny is known at that time as an individual before God. We talked earlier in the show that this is kind of an unnatural state because we're not angels. We're not supposed to be pure spirits. We're body-soul composites, and that's how God wanted us. But because of sin, we died. So does the human person remain in either heaven or hell as a disembodied soul for all eternity?
No. And this actually gets to the second type of judgment. So first, there's that particular judgment for that person. Now, at the end of time, right? So it's not that we live on this earth indefinitely.
Yeah, there's going to be an end of history.
There's going to be an end. And it is here where the perfection of our potential seeks will come to its fruition, so to speak. So this idea, again, that which is in potential, which is us, desires a perfection by our nature.
I think what you're saying is that everybody desires continuous life.
Yes.
Everybody desires that.
It's not just as individual persons, right?
Yeah.
I'm not just a standalone species by myself. I'm a human. You're human. We all belong to this interconnected species.
Mm-hmm.
And so this general judgment isn't just in relation to individual persons. It's as a whole. There is this reconciliation that goes on with humanity as a whole.
Okay.
With God. And part and parcel with that is not just the restoration of what our material being was in the beginning, but the perfection of what it was ultimately designed to be.
Ultimately,
in this union with God.
All right. So let me let me put that together in other words. You're saying that at the end of history, and you believe as a Christian, that Christ will come back again as judge to judge the living and the dead, whenever that end is, and there will be a general resurrection and a general judgment.
Yes.
So then the souls that are already dead, that have been judged to be in heaven or hell, they will be publicly judged? They will be a part of the whole?
That's a good question. There's actually a certain mystery to that. There's very little revealed about what exactly entails the general judgment, just that it will be happening, and that part and parcel of that would be the restoration of what things are meant to be, both for those who chose God and those who did not, and aka the damned.
Yeah, and there's a school of thought, and tell me where it comes from, that that the judgment, in this general judgment at the end of history, when all people will be gathered together in the presence of Christ, that everyone's life and everyone's sins will be on display, in a sense.
Oh, yes. Everyone
will be totally transparent.
That's correct. And to a certain degree, one could, I suppose, it would make sense in an intuitive way that it was designed to be that way from the beginning. The deception, the secrets, the lack of trust in each other was not designed to be there from the beginning.
Sin made that happen. Yeah.
Exactly. And there was supposed to be a perfect openness, a perfect sharing between individuals and with God.
Right. So that may happen there at the final judgment.
Yes.
A lot of people are thinking, well, I've done a lot of sins, and gosh, I don't want them revealed at the end of time in front of everybody, but in a sense, if you're on the right track, if you're in union with God,
the scandal won't be there anymore.
Exactly, as I'm trying to say, it would. There would be no scandal. There would be the folks that are going to heaven are all going to embrace God's forgiveness and God's mercy, and it won't be what you think it would be, I would imagine.
No, not at all. There would actually be, I think, a perfect joy that happens.
Mm. All right, so you mentioned that those who have said no to God in this life also get their bodies back. So
yes,
there's a reunification of body and soul in both those who are damned and those who are saved.
Yes.
Now, those who are saved, their bodies will be what scripture or tradition mentions as glorified, right? They'll have beautiful glorified bodies, perhaps something like Christ's moment of the transfiguration in the
yes.
Gospels.
And that's according to the degree of their love.
Very, very beautiful resurrected bodies. But what about, do we know anything about the bodies of the damned?
What we do know is that they'll get them back, and we can speculate pretty well that the torments that they would have spiritually before would be extended to their physical bodies as well.
So physical pain as well as spiritual pain.
Yes.
Constant and eternal.
It would be a both and.
Hmm. Yeah, that's something that many Christians used to ponder about. In fact, this was traditionally called the four last things, death, judgment, heaven, and hell, wasn't it?
Yes, and it was actually encouraged as part of a healthy way to look at ourselves, is to say, what is our ultimate destiny and where do we want to go?
Yeah, because if you don't have that end or destiny or purpose, then you have no way of knowing how to live this life.
Exactly.
So, makes sense. Thank you, Mr. John Tudorus. Another beautiful and worthy discussion with you on our first Friday of the month. There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. What is death? Well, hope you got a little taste of what it might mean for the human race tonight in this Lenten season. Thank you for listening. I'm Paul Morano. You've been listening to Beneath the Surface. Be back with you next week, same time, same channel. Have a great week, everyone.
Looking for a way to build daily prayer discipline? Seen the rise in mindfulness meditation, but not sure if it is possible to meditate in a way that's consistent with your Catholic faith? Just looking for a way to breathe new life into your existing prayer routine? No matter what you're looking for, Holo is here to help. Holo is a Catholic prayer and meditation app that helps users deepen their relationship with God through audio-guided contemplative prayer sessions. From meditations on the daily gospel, to the rosary, to daily examines, Holo has something for everyone. Holo is the number one Catholic app in the U.S. It is free to download and has permanently free content, but you can also check out all of the premium sessions for 30 days, risk-free, by signing up at www.holo.app/breadbox.